This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have two sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software and the second XMA, and we'll tell you more about both of those as the show goes on. Bradley, how's it going?
Good. You know, this is the only time in the history of Out of School that I am ahead of you on time zones.
Yes, we have never done it this way before. Yeah, so it's the crack of dawn here, 6:30 a.m. in San Francisco. But I am here for the Apple Developer Conference, WWDC 2016. And I guess what we're going to talk about today, Bradley, is what has just happened this week.
Sounds good. This is one of those years we went into obviously knowing really no new hardware. And it really, the years we got hardware, was always the exception. And this keynote was fast moving. I watched half of it live and caught the recap on the other half. But what was your opinion of watchOS 3?
Yeah, so they kicked off with watchOS 3, and I think in many respects, like at least the people who own an Apple Watch, that was something that I think most people were very enthusiastic about. And, you know, I've seen some comment online already where it's like, oh, well, this is obviously the thing they should have done in version 1. But I don't think that accounts for the fact that watchOS 3 kind of is a big rethink based on a year's worth of actual experience in the real world with real apps, in real situations. And I'm kind of very pleased to see that Apple had enough kind of humility, if you like, to actually take some of those major features and almost just get rid of them. So if you remember when the watch first came out, the three things were it's a watch, it's a fitness tracker, and it's for communication, you know, through the friends button and digital touch. And in reality, I mean, I think everybody who's got an Apple Watch knows that basically nobody uses that feature. So that feature's almost completely gone as far as I can see. And that side button is now the button that gets you into the dock on the watch.
You know, that's interesting because you would think some of these features, like I recognize after like 10 minutes, some of these features were garbage. Yeah. And so you wonder why they didn't kind of recognize that either.
Yeah, I think I was at the talk show recording on Tuesday night, and Craig Federighi and Phil Schiller were there, and they had a little bit more discussion about this issue. And what Craig Federighi said was that basically they were so paranoid about power usage and battery life on the watch that they had been really conservative about what they were doing. And because they had to sort of discovered in real life that they had a lot more power budget than they thought, what they're now able to do is use those apps that you put in this dock space that's on the watch now. They sort of stay resident in memory all the time. So it's kind of like they're spending their power and memory budget on something else now. And I think, you know, it's these things take time, I guess. But they're very much kind of pushing the line that you can do all this on the existing hardware. It'll make your existing watch feel like a new one kind of thing. So I'm really looking forward to that, actually. I think it's going to be a big enhancement. And I think the way that people will use their watch will change again, because you also have this new feature where you can swipe left and right on the watch face to get to another watch face. And you know how a lot of people have actually got multiple watch faces configured for different purposes. And I think what people will start to do is to have multiple watch faces and use them as kind of mini app collections in themselves. I think that's going to be quite a cool way to work with your watch in the future. So you might have one for, you know, doing a workout or traveling or commuting even, and then one for, you know, during your workday, and one for playing with your kids and so on. I think that could be quite a useful and very interesting way to kind of configure the things you do on your watch.
Yeah, I don't know that there was enough there to make me want to rebuy one. Mm-hmm. I think to me I imagine there's new hardware coming this fall, and for serious fitness tracking, I still think there's lack of GPS is killing it in a way, but could easily come with a new watch.
Yeah, I was standing in line with a couple of guys who were serious kind of runners, and they were both wearing, you know, Garmin or Polar watches, and they were like, yeah, you know, this is A, it's more robust than an Apple Watch, and B, the battery lasts longer as well, because, you know, the experience of workouts on the watch has been that they are quite intensive on the battery. So I think that market, but the sort of casual fitness tracking is, they really sort of doubled down on that, and there was a kind of a slightly awkward moment I felt in the room where they were talking about the way that wheelchair users have different sort of motions of their watch when they're working their wheelchair. And they showed a picture of the screen which says, instead of it says time to stand, they've changed it to time to roll if you're configured for a wheelchair use. And there was a distinctly palpable awkward moment in the room where people weren't really sure if they could clap for that or not. But eventually everybody decided they were going to clap for it, and we got past it and it was fine. But it was, and people have been very kind about those features since, but there was a distinct moment of awkwardness in the room there, and I detected.
I think back to when MP3 players were very dominant and phones were just starting to get some of those music features. Mm-hmm. And we may be there with dedicated fitness watches versus these, I guess, quote unquote, smart watches. Mm-hmm. So it may be, and obviously now, largely no one has dedicated MP3 players. I don't mean that no one buys them, but on a whole, the average person uses their phone for that now for music. And it may take 3 or 4 more years before the smartwatch technology can do enough and has a long enough battery to get through, say, a marathon. Where now you really couldn't. And so we may be with phones, maybe go back to 2004, looking at MP3 players versus music on your phone. We may be there with smartwatches versus fitness watches.
Yeah, I think with the phones and MP3 players, the issue was storage capacity, really, wasn't it? Whereas this one's about battery life. But your point is well made. And I think that my sense is that what's happening with the Apple Watch is it's kind of expanding the market for fitness tracking, in that many people who are using their watch for that are sort of first-generation fitness tracker users, whereas the people who have really been into those kind of metrics before, they'll still be using those dedicated devices for some time to come, but probably not forever. Forever's a long time in technology, isn't it?
Oh, that's absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Before we move on to our next topic, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the great folks at XMA. They have a great program. It's called the All Learn program for iPad, that if you are concerned about, managing your deployment, planning your deployment, financing your deployment, XMA is who you want to contact. They're an Apple solution expert, and they've been doing this for over 30 years. So again, if you need help with training, they can use their accredited trainers to deliver Apple professional development workshops to your teachers and staff to ensure you get the best results from your deployment. Again, like we've always said, the best deployment or the worst deployment, the most expensive one is the one that doesn't work. So XMA can help you avoid that. Check them out at xma.co.uk/out of school or follow them on Twitter at @wearexma. Again, thanks to XMA and the All Learn program for iPad for sponsoring this week's Out of School.
Okay, so there was vague mention of tvOS as well. I mean, there wasn't a huge amount new came to Apple TV. Basically, a dark mode and the ability to put in your password once for this crazy American TV system that you have over here, where everybody's got their different logins, which got a huge cheer in the audience, right? And I think, actually, I'm kind of waving my hand at that because, it doesn't affect me, that kind of problem. But I think it gives... there was a play for Apple to kind of be like the first thing on your HDMI connection, rather than your TiVo box or whatever, because now they're really trying to make it kind of like the universal thing that you can actually watch live TV through, as well as these sort of on-demand services as well. And that's certainly how we use our Apple TV at home in the UK. So I think it's a big deal for certain markets, specifically the US, but there wasn't a huge ton of new features. But they also announced that you can now make games that don't work with a Siri remote that you have to have a game controller for. So that'll maybe expand a little bit the kind of games you see on Apple TV too.
Yeah, when I told my wife about those new features of tvOS, she liked those. Number one, we need a dark mode. It's really bright at night.
Yeah.
And the problem with even the sign-in system on the American TV is it's you not only have to do it for every app, but then it periodically times out on every app. It seems like regardless of how often you use it. So you're once a month you're having to log in there and do that. So this would be fantastic. This will be great for, 75% of the people that are using their parents' Comcast login for this stuff. That would be fantastic for them. So it's a great feature. And I imagine, I have never... I know a lot of people think the future of TV is paying $10 a month for 100 channels. And that's just not... You're not going to pay $10 and get Hollywood level content. I think almost the future could be you pay Comcast $50 a month for a Comcast login.
Yeah, and then you get whatever is through those channels. Yeah.
So, yeah, the thumbs up for me there. And I mean, not a lot of new stuff, but it's a fairly new product. And I mean, so much of the TV experience is just video playing. So it would be like if your iPhone could only play videos. Like, what would you expect a new OS to do?
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things that they had, I was at last night an education sort of mixer event after the hours of the conference. And what they were starting to try and kind of show off a little bit was more kind of educational apps for the Apple TV. Now, there wasn't a whole lot there right now, but there's a couple of developers showing off a few things. And I think it's taking people some time to kind of think up ways to use the TV. I mean, there are some apps, you know, you've probably seen like the TripAdvisor app and things like that on the Apple TV, which are really nice. And the Airbnb app is actually really cool. But I think it's going to take people some time to get ideas for the Apple TV. But I think eventually we will actually see some more kind of actual apps rather than just, you know, video content. But right now, that's obviously the huge focus of the platform. And fair enough, yeah.
Yeah. So iOS 10. I guess overall, this did not seem like a huge upgrade for schools. And I'll say two things. Number one, iOS 9 was huge for schools, and then iOS 9.3 brought us some much needed features. So if it's like there may, you know, a lot of everything that was announced, and we'll go through that in a second quickly because I know many of you have already read this, but I give it a thumbs up, because if we had gotten like all the new iOS 9.3 stuff in iOS 10, we would be giving it like, you know, five thumbs up.
Yeah, exactly. If you kind of put together 9.3 and 10 as one release, then yeah, it's a really big deal. And we just got some of that stuff early. And I think there might be a little bit of a hangover from that, you know, in terms of, you know, we didn't see a whole lot for iPad, but the iPad team had just done a whole ton of stuff not that long ago. So yeah, maybe that's what it's all about.
Well, and again, I mean, I haven't. Now, I will say I have still not gotten my Apple School Manager invite, and I don't really know of anyone that has. And I talked to my systems engineer this week, and he basically said, give us a few more days. So they do need to get on that. It is getting closer and closer to July.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're a large district that has a large deployment, you really can't wait till the end of July to start this. I mean, I could get away with that, and you could get away with that. Yep. But a school of 10,000 iPads has got to have this now.
Yeah, pretty much. And the people I spoke to were, let's just say, intensely aware of that fact. So it does seem to be now actually imminent that, you know, in the next couple of weeks, some things will start to happen. But they know that that's got to happen quite soon. There's a real hard deadline on that. So, I mean, the iOS 10 announcements were, honestly, I felt kind of underwhelming and very much focused on the phone. And also quite focused on, how can I put this, demographics that are not me, perhaps. So there's actually not a lot that's changed. I mean, I've got an iOS 10 device beside me here, and the home screen and lock screen experience is actually dramatically different. I mean, for a start, you no longer swipe to unlock, right? So when you're looking at a locked device on the that is on with the home screen, you can swipe over to the left and you get the kind of widgets that used to be in Notification Center. But if you just swipe anywhere on the screen to the right, you go straight to the camera. So this makes it really, really easy to get to the camera, as you just sort of turn the device on and swipe right to left across the screen and you're in the camera immediately. So instead of having to grab that little thing in the corner and pull it all the way up, it makes it much easier to get into the camera now, which I think is obviously something that people want, is as fast as possible access to the camera at all times. Yeah, so that was the thing. And the way you get into the phone now is you, if you don't use Touch ID, what you do is you press the home button to wake the device up, and then you press the home button again to unlock the screen. Yeah, so swipe to unlock is finally gone after 10 years. So that was pretty good. The other thing I really liked was the enhancement to the Photos app. So that looks really good. Yeah, it's playing a bit of catch up to Google Photos, but I think, you know, Photos is one of my favorite apps, and I use iCloud Photo Library a lot. So that was kind of my feature, if you like, from the whole thing. Was there anything else that kind of caught your eye, Bradley?
Some of the VoIP stuff for the enterprise, I think, will be big. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're seeing like Apple and Cisco kind of partner on some things networking wise, and this really seems largely targeted at big, you know, like, you know, Fortune 500 type companies. These, like, you know, yeah, the VoIP hooks and things like that. So I think, you know, a lot of the ideas here, this your internal phone system would just be replaced by an iOS device.
Yeah, I mean, that absolutely could happen. And I think as, even in the consumer space, you know, if you look at something like Slack, for example, now supporting audio calling between individual users on Slack, and WeChat and things, is it WeChat or WhatsApp or whatever? I think, you know, it takes those apps like Skype on the phone as well. The call experience has always been a real second-class experience, and it puts it kind of right up there as well. So that was kind of cool. The map stuff I thought was potentially interesting, depending on what people do with it. As far as I can see, there's not a way for people to actually put additional markers on the map, which is what I thought would be the kind of interesting one, because you know, I drive an electric car, and one of the things about driving an electric car is you've got to know where the charge points are, otherwise you're in trouble. So I thought, well, this could be cool if, you know, PlugShare, which is an app that sort of crowdsources both the position and reliability of chargers, if PlugShare could put their EV points right on the map, that would be really cool. I don't think you can actually do that, but I haven't really looked into it in detail. So, yeah, anything that makes maps better is good, I think. But other parts were felt a wee bit kind of like Apple really wants this to be a thing, so they're putting a big focus on it in the keynote, but people weren't all that in love with it. You know, like news, for example. That got more keynote time than I kind of expected.
You know, going back to the maps, you know, there's the heavy Uber and Lyft and, like, OpenTable integration.
Yeah.
That... I don't know. Like, I feel like in some ways, I don't want to, I'm trying to say this in a way that isn't like rude. I think that like assumes that you work in Silicon Valley and you take Uber to lunch every day to fancy restaurants.
Yeah. And it's a San Francisco feature, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I mean, the only time I use Uber are like twice a year. So,
yeah.
Like if I travel, that's when I use Uber. And I've booked like two reservations through OpenTable. A, because like we just don't go out to eat that much because we have three children, and B, like not a lot of the restaurants in Chattanooga support OpenTable, and mm-hmm. the ones that do aren't busy enough where like I need it, and then like I guess the last point is I know that restaurants get like totally screwed when they use OpenTable, and I book through OpenTable money wise, so I just by that point just don't even use it. So I mean I use Google Maps, like I all those features are like thumbs up on. I just wonder like. Almost feels like flyover to me. Looks good on a demo, but like I really never use it.
Yeah, I think it's one of these things, a bit like the iMessage hooks, is very much up to like what do the developers do with it? And then do you have developers in your area that really take advantage of it? Like, you know, you could imagine maybe like the National Trust in the UK might do something really cool where you can like prepay your parking or whatever at National Trust properties, or even join National Trust right inside maps or whatever, you know, show where all the properties are or whatever. But I mean, my experience has been that those organizations don't do a good job with apps, you know. So it's great if you're in a San Francisco kind of area, I think, you know.
Yeah, I don't mean to, you know, they're neat features. I just don't think they're features that are saying things I will use day to day. I mean, I don't even use a Maps app day to day. I have Google Maps on. The main reason I have Google Maps is to search for restaurants, and I can find them. Google Maps has like restaurant menus integrated. That's and we're picking up to go food. Like that's how I use Maps. I drive to work and to home. That's my like, you know, 6 out of 7 days. That's the only places I go is to work and to home.
Yeah, there's not a ton of 30-something dad features in iOS 10, I have to say.
Right. You know, but one of the things I think, and this is where I want to spend a little bit of time, is talking about device support. So your fourth-generation iPad or newer, this was the second Retina iPad with Lightning. It was that fall 2013 device. You know, we had that spring device that was the iPad 3 that was heavier than the iPad 2, and that was kind of the big rub on it, even though it was Retina. And so it's that device or newer, iPad Mini 2 or newer, and then iPhone 5 or newer. And I've seen some kind of pushback on this, you know, among my social channels for schools, you know, frustrated that iPad 2 is being axed. And number one, you know, if you listen to this show, you know that we've been predicting the death of the A5 chip for a long time. It's been a drag on iOS development for years. And so second thing is, just because your device doesn't support iOS 10 doesn't mean it stops working the day iOS 10 is released. Yeah. As apps go, iOS 10 only, you may be missing out on some existing features, and there may be new apps that you can't deploy, But if you have an app that's on your iPad that works on your iPad that day, it won't update and then just stop working. If it requires a version of iOS that it can't run, you won't be off of that update. So again, where this might get tricky is if you have like a cloud service that it somehow stops working with. But good developers of educational apps are not going to be cutting off iOS 9 devices for a while.
Yeah, there are some new APIs in iOS 10 that people are going to like to use, but I don't know that it's necessarily stuff that people will immediately have to dive on. I mean, it's not quite like iOS multitasking, for example, where people are going to want that straight away. So yeah, I think I feel a little bit bad for schools that just bought iPad Mini 1s a year ago. I mean, like the very, very last adopters of that old technology. So the newest iPad 2 in the world is 2 years old, and the newest iPad Mini 1 is 1 year old. So there are still schools iPad Mini 1 is still under Apple Care, right? But, it wasn't a good technology choice at the time, and we certainly said that a few times, but, schools have got limited budgets. You've got to do what you've got to do. But things are starting to finally move on with iPad, I think. And you sort of see that with things like Shared iPad, Apple Classroom. They're starting to get away from that 2011 generation of hardware a little bit.
Before we move on, let's thank our great friends at Jamf Software for sponsoring this episode for their Casper Suite for Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs. If you have an iPad deployment that you're doing this fall, I definitely recommend the Casper Suite. They had day one support for all of the iOS 9.3 features. They have a hosted version that you can use. You can host it on your own hardware, at Amazon, at Mac Mini Colo, really anywhere. Can't recommend these folks enough. So check them out at jampsoftware.com. Again, thanks to Jamf, the Casper Suite, for sponsoring this episode of Out of School.
Okay, so I suppose the big thing we have to talk about is Swift Playgrounds. I wondered whether education would get some keynote time, and we certainly did in terms of this whole Swift Playgrounds business. But I think the first thing to understand, I've spent the last 2 days just kind of drinking from the fire hose of information about Swift Playgrounds. The first thing to understand is that this is part of a much wider Apple initiative, which is called Everyone Can Code. And there's web pages about this on apple.com. And there's also things like books that are coming out as well. So the app is the first part of it. The second part is the tutorial content that's inside, or not even tutorial content, but curriculum content that's inside the app itself. And then the last part is that there are 3 iBooks currently available in preview form on the iBook store, all about learning Swift, basically. So there's a teacher guide for Swift Playgrounds, and then there's a pair of books called App Development with Swift. Those are kind of the bridge to using Xcode on the Mac, if you like. But there's a student book and a teacher guide for App Development with Swift as well, and that's kind of more targeted at high school. But the Swift Playgrounds app and the content that's called Learn to Code 1, which is that's the interactive world with the little monster that you saw in the keynote. That's part of sort of designed for middle school, if you like. I've had a look at it. I've got it running on an iPad here. It's really pretty good overall. I'm really, really interested to see where this goes.
Yeah, it was exciting. The things I've seen about the app so far seem very... They put a lot of thought into various age groups, and it feels like they're kind of trying to make this on par with like code.org and Scratch and things like that. So fantastic.
Yeah, it is interesting from a sort of computer science education point of view that there's a distinct difference between what they're doing with Playgrounds and what happens in Scratch and Hopscotch and so on. And the difference is that even from the very first lesson that you do in Learn to Code 1, you're actually writing legit Swift code, the exact same kind of code that you would write to write an iOS app. Whereas with Hopscotch and Scratch, and this is always a problem I've had actually teaching computer science, is that you teach all this block-based programming, and then you have to somehow get the kids from there into textual programming. Whereas Swift Playgrounds doesn't really make an apology for that, but it has a lot of mechanisms for the authors of books to simplify what the reader sees. So you can actually have a lot of code running on your page, but there are ways to kind of comment out parts of it so that it's there and it runs, but it's actually hidden from the user. So there are lots of different ways you can mark up your source code to make it much easier for younger students to type things in the right places and to not screw up the environment they're working on. Because when I teach Python programming at school, what I do is I give the kids a sample program, and it's fine as long as they kind of follow the instructions, but if they are not clear on where they need to edit the code, they can actually break the sample program, then have to fix it before they can continue. Whereas the Swift Playgrounds app lets the instructor sort of direct the students a little bit more, which is really good for younger kids because then they can't break the whole thing. So let me tell you a little bit about the Swift Playgrounds app itself first, and then talk about some other things as well. Where to start? Swift Playgrounds have been around for a while. They've been in Xcode on the Mac. And basically what a playground is an interactive worksheet that runs code as you type it, and it shows you the results in a right-hand sidebar on the window. And this makes it really easy to kind of play around with stuff and test out code and so on. And those are actually fully supported in the Playgrounds app. So you can take a worksheet that you've run on Xcode on the Mac, and you can airdrop it to your iPad, and it will run straight away on the Playgrounds app. But there is another aspect to this, which is the idea of what are called Playground Books. And these seem to me like the bigger play in this whole thing. So taking a Playground from Xcode is fine, but what you can actually do is you, on your Mac, or possibly on an iPad as well, you can actually author an entire book, and you can create chapters and pages. And in those chapters and pages, there can be code that runs, and image resources, and videos, and scene kit files, and animations and stuff. Excuse me, that's my alarm going off. We're up too early. And what you can do with that book is you can actually build learning and navigation structure through it, and then deliver that to students, and they can work their way through it. There's all kinds of stuff in there that I haven't completely explored yet, but you can actually have things like the book can actually track assessment as well. So you can, on every page, you can have a kind of, has the student passed this lesson? Have they failed it? And you can actually track that all the way through the book as well. So it's really interesting. One thing to understand, though, about the Playgrounds app is that it itself is not an authoring environment, okay? Because what happens is when you drop a book or a playground onto your iPad, the work that you do on the iPad is actually stored as a diff from the original book. So it looks like you're editing the playground or the book, but you're actually not. You're creating separate information. And the reason for that is so that the student can actually reset the page if they get confused, and they can actually reset the whole book. So you don't always, you're not permanently changing the stuff that you've got. You can actually download it, work in it, and then reset it and do it again. So that's how it works on the iPad. So you do have to kind of author outside of the Playgrounds app. And you'll do that on the Mac, but there may be ways being built at the moment to do it, not by Apple, but by third parties, to also do it on the iPad as well.
Yeah, it's this is one of those things that I don't think this is going to be something that we... Yeah, I don't know. Like, I could see... We won't have this day one school, but I could see this be something that we look at, like, in January, we come back to school. About really rolling out in the classroom.
Well, first thing to say is that it's tied to iOS 10, so it's not going to ship till iOS 10 ships, so you're looking at least sort of January before, you're right, absolutely January, before that's really going to be a thing that you use. I'm looking at it right now, as it even exists right now, I think I can drop in Learn to Code 1 in place of my existing hopscotch course for, what is that, 7th grade kids that I have, 6th grade kids that I have, learning that stuff at the moment. After that, the question is, do I convert other things to that and see where I go with it? I'm not sure.
Well, and then, you know, see, this could have some really nice integration with iTunes U going forward as well.
Yeah. There's some features that I think the app needs right now in its first build, just to make it kind of possible to do classroom management. But one particular thing is you can't... What you are allowed to do is you're allowed to airdrop your Swift Playgrounds to other people, which is kind of cool. But there's not really a way to, for example, like turn the student's work into a PDF and submit it through iTunes U, at least not yet. So there's a little bit there that needs to be done.
Yeah, certainly not bad. This is like, again, I think like everything that comes out in the summer, this is probably not, this is something we may play with this year, but it may be a heavy part of curriculum, like fall of 17.
I suppose my question is, if you have to author an NX code on the Mac, how many, well, for a start, how many teachers even got a Mac? And the answer probably rounds to zero outside the US. How many teachers want to go and buy a Mac just to start teaching Swift? Probably, again, the answer is zero. So I think the question of authoring content for Swift Playgrounds is, that's a tricky question at the moment. So I think it will be on Apple to create some authoring tools for these books. But I think I can also see like some teachers who want to do this stuff creating content and sharing it online, so that people could maybe just adopt what other people have written, because that's perfectly easy to do. There's no real difficulty in doing that. So that's probably where that sits at the moment.
So yeah, exciting stuff. I'm excited about that. Really, really am. This will be something that I think our kids will be excited about. Our kids. Again, I go back to this is all, even if you're not big on coding itself, just the creative problem-solving skills you learn from it and use with it are exciting.
Yeah, very, very much. And I think the other thing to say about Playgrounds is that it's, like, if you know how to program iOS, right, you can literally program against the entire iOS API. So you can bring in, the motion sensors, the accelerometers on the iPad. You can bring in GPS information. You can create little user interfaces. You could do all kinds of stuff. I mean, you've got access to almost literally everything that iOS can do. Play sounds, play MIDI, the camera, image manipulation APIs, all kinds of stuff. And you can actually show the results sort of right in Swift Playgrounds as well. So although it looks like what you saw in the keynote looked very kind of baby and basic, there is an enormous amount of headroom in that system to do really big things. Okay, you're not going to write an app and ship it out of Swift Playgrounds, but you could build a Swift Playground that itself could do some really cool stuff. So it's definitely something that is going to develop, but I think the fundamentals are right. And it's just a matter of like deciding what to do with it now and also kind of where it has to evolve in certain areas over time.
So have you learned anything new on iOS deployment? I know there was a session. I haven't gotten to watch it yet, but just from your conversations that you can share.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the Swift Playground session and the MDM session were on at the same time this week. So the only two sessions I really wanted to go to, I had to pick one. But there's video of them all, so I'll catch up with that later. I did spend some good time talking to people in the deployment labs. There were a lot of SEs and people were there, and I sat down with one guy for about an hour and just talked through some of the things that were going on. My sense is that deployment best practices are starting to evolve in the light of deeper experience with one-to-ones. And what we were talking about there was primarily the idea of, what do you do with managed Apple IDs? What do you do with app deployment? And not just deployment, but selection of apps as well. So I was heavily encouraged, shall we say, to seriously consider device-based assignment. That seems to be the new, it's not required, but it's, it seems to be the sort of best practice for school deployment is to use device-based assignment. And the reason for that is that experience seems to have shown that when you do user-based assignment of apps, almost no kids install school apps on their personal devices, even when they're using the same Apple ID. And at the same time, when you give kids their own Apple ID and give them the freedom of the App Store, they all install the same 10 apps, right? Which is Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, Spotify, Netflix, and Hulu, and so on. So there's what we haven't really seen huge exploration of the App Store by students in general. I mean, of course, there's some people who have, but in general, we're seeing kids adding a little bit of entertainment to their devices and not really taking the school stuff to their personal devices at the same time. So what I was what was suggested to me was that when using managed Apple IDs, the students can't access the App Store themselves, so the school has to kind of curate a set of apps that can be deployed through mobile device management servers. And the way I was sort of encouraged to think about this was that schools might get a little bit more liberal about which apps they put in their MDM. So indeed, putting some games in the MDM, some social networking apps and some content apps and so on. But then having all of those apps be managed so that if you do have a problem, you know, say somebody's parent objects to them having access to a game or something like that, you could exclude that user from access to that app. And because every single app that's on the device is managed, you can just pull that app back from that user and they don't have it anymore. So that was kind of a new way to think about it. And that was also suggested to me as the way to think about how to deploy 17 plus apps if you need them in the school. So you remember this thing that we talked about before, about being able, it's great to be able to blacklist an app that is available to students under your age rating, but you don't want it. But there's not really a way to sort of punch through your age rating limit to get to a 17 plus app if you want it. So what was the way I was told to think about it was, don't bother deploying age ratings at all. If you're using managed Apple ID and you're curating all the apps yourself, then you don't need to worry about what the age rating are because you chose every single app that went into your MDM. So whether it's 17 plus or 4 plus or whatever, that's irrelevant because you've already approved the app yourself. So essentially, with managed Apple ID, the school gets to do the app review, if you like, and only then do you put it out if you think it's the right thing to do. So that was quite an interesting sort of new way to think about it.
As an app reviewer for your school, you're saying that you could be bribed to approve certain apps. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically that there would be some kind of process by which students could either request or propose that everybody gets a certain kind of app, and then you just would look at it yourself. Maybe a little bit more work for the school, but I'm certainly looking at many apps already for school. And what's also happened in the past year in my experience is that individual students have asked me for specific apps that they wanted. So mostly for out-of-school activities, like I'm doing a music theory test and I need a specific app for a specific instrument, or I got a GoPro camera for Christmas, can I get the GoPro app on my iPad, or can I get this drone app, and so on. And I've certainly done that already for individual students, but in the case of, you know, using managed Apple IDs and a curated app store, if you like, inside your MDM, you could easily throw those things out there and people could just install them from self-service if they want to, and then, you know, you don't really have to bother too much about it. So the other thing that I got was I got my first demo of shared iPad. There'd been some events in London, but I hadn't been able to go to any of them. So this was kind of my first time seeing shared iPad. And there was the woman from Apple was demoing. They shared a teacher iPad and 5 student iPads. And that looked really slick, to be honest with you. I know it probably didn't have a huge load of data in it, but the experience looked really nice in terms of the student's login experience, and getting to the home screen times, login and logout times seemed very consistent. And some of the folks at Apple were telling me that they tested a number of third-party apps and compatibility already looked good with shared iPad. Most people were doing more or less the right things, and that was really good to hear.
Yeah, I am anxious to get my hands on this and see it day to day. I play with it in the labs, but I am just really anxious to see it day to day, especially to push it hard.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting solution for schools. My slight concern is that it sort of requires like really competent admins to kind of understand all the parts that comprise shared iPad. So you need to be an Apple school manager, manage the Apple IDs, MDM support, etc., etc. And it seems to me a little bit that a lot of the schools that have shared iPads don't have that kind of level of management going on in the school yet. But maybe that's, you know, the investment is either you have this kind of messy self-deployment situation or you get a proper deployment, but you get the benefit of having a very good shared iPad experience. So yeah, it seemed to work very well, and it was a very kind of consistent personalized experience on the devices. But do you remember, Bradley, we talked before about using shared iPad as a kind of disaster recovery mechanism?
Yeah.
Where the idea being that everybody was in shared iPad, including all the spares, and then we just used that as a way to log into a new iPad really quickly. I was kind of gently waved off of that idea by people that I talked to. And the point was kind of made to me that, look, if you have caching server and you have device enrollment and you have your MDM set up, how much time are you really going to save by having shared iPad in place? And I kind of came to realize that, yeah, it's probably it sort of felt to me like I was just being too clever for my own good by thinking about doing that. So I'm probably not going to do that. So I think shared iPad is good when you need it, but using it if you don't need it just seems like a little bit of overkill. So I'm probably going to just leave that idea by the wayside.
Maybe the analogy is like running a VPN when it's your home internet.
Yeah, kind of like that. You know, it's, you are super secure, but, you know, why bother?
Right. That's good. I think a lot of these things, when we get Apple SQL Manager up and running and day-to-day, yeah, we'll see the impact on some of this. And now we're just stuck all ideas and theory. So, again, I'm hoping I get my invite before, like, the week of the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. I'd really like to see that soon. Yeah. Because there again, these will be fast deployments. My biggest hurdle is going to be unboxing everything, the actual individual boxes that the iPads come in. And other than that, should be fairly fast.
Oh, the other thing I was going to say is, just in conversations with people here as well, I was also encouraged to not forget about Apple Configurator, because one of the things that we were talking about, you know, how do we actually get to zero-touch deployment? And one of the things that I was encouraged to look at was the possibility of using Apple Configurator to initiate the device enrollment process. So when you bring the device out of the box, you can plug them all into Configurator, and Configurator, instead of kind of glomming onto those iPads like it used to, it can just be used to trigger the first piece of the deployment. So the phrase that was used to me was like, you never have to touch the glass, right? So you just plug them in to Configurator and you can actually just run that right from those devices. So I'm going to be exploring that a little bit more, just as a kind of kickstart to the whole deployment. And that would be a nice way to churn through a whole lot of iPads really quickly.
Oh, absolutely. So you've had a good trip though?
Yeah, it's been great. I have met people from years ago. It's been really cool, actually. There's, you know, people that I knew like 10 or 15 years ago in the kind of Apple world. I managed to just somehow bump into them at this gigantic conference, and it's been really cool to catch up with people. So, it's been a great trip, and my focus all week has been Swift Playgrounds. You know, I have really ignored almost everything else except that, because it's been such a kind of learning curve so far. But I think it's a very interesting start, and I may have to go and buy another iPad just to try it out now.
All right, Mike Hurley, having two iPads. Yeah. No, that's a joke. But I'm glad you've had a good trip. I know you're probably ready to get back home.
Yes.
We were texting last night, and you know, I realized the jet lag that'd be terrible. And you said that you are catching up now, but just as you go home.
So. That's how it works. Yeah.
True. Yeah. So, sounds good. It'll be an exciting rest of summer as we kind of watch these developments mature, public beta in July. That's when I will probably upgrade my devices. Be fun. Thanks, everybody, for listening this week. I'm on the web at chambersdaily.com. I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
Okay, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
Have a great week, everybody.